This is Report to Wyoming.
This show targets local issues that matter right here in Natrona County, where we talk to real people about their thoughts and ideas. For today's episode, I wanted to chat with Susan Burke about Wyoming's hospice care. And with Veterans Day right around the corner, we touch on a special program called We Honor Veterans that addresses care specific to vets, including honoring them for their service. But anyway, how's your week going this far?
Busy. It's good. It's good, but it's busy.
Would you mind sharing a little bit about yourself? How did you wind up in Casper?
Oh, my goodness. I wound up in Casper because my husband took a job at Casper College in the theater department. That was in 1991. Honestly, we expected to stay a few years, maybe 5 years, and it's been, 31 years now? We were both working as professional actors when we decided that maybe something a little steadier might be a good thing for a while. So I looked around and there was really no professional theater to be had in Casper. So I was applying for a job as a copywriter at a radio station. And they looked at my resume and saw my performance stuff and they said, can you do live radio? And I said, well, I don't know. I've never tried. So they auditioned me and I ended up on the air on KTRS radio in 1991. And that's how I came to Casper.
Now, if you could only pick two adjectives to describe Casper, what would they be?
Independent. Thriving.
How did you end up working in hospice?
You know, I feel like it was a calling for me. When my mother passed away in, it was 2004, her illness was very unexpected. We were headed home to Iowa thinking we were going to spend the Christmas holiday with her, and she was having some minor surgery that kind of went wrong while we were on the road. And during the course of that, the doctors discovered that she had cancer she had kidney cancer before, but they had pronounced her cured. That she had had cancer that had spread to her liver and that her organs were failing. And by the time we reached her, she was hospitalized, and it became clear that it was a terminal situation, and that was totally out of the blue. I had no idea where to turn and who to talk to and how to even begin to process this imminent death. And there was a lady from our church, or their church, it was my home church, who had worked for hospice and knew a lot about hospice. And she came in and she was the angel for our family and held my hand and said, "What do you need? Who can I call? You know, let me call the hospice people and see how they can help." And she helped guide us through, you know, my mom passed just a few days later, helped guide us through that and keep us stable and, you know, did the same with my dad some years later. And I thought, you know what, I want to be that person for someone. I want to be the person who puts their hand on your arm and says, "What do you need? How can we help you? What's the best way that I can walk this journey with you?" And so when this opportunity came up at hospice, I said, well, that's it. That's what I need to be doing.
As you're describing this, I'm wondering, do people usually reach out to you or vice versa when they're going through something similar?
It's a little bit of both. It's... you know, my job is to do this and to make sure that people know that we're there, what our services are, that they don't need to be afraid of us. They don't need to be afraid of the word hospice, that we're there with them when they need us. A lot of times they'll reach out to us because of the messaging that I've done or the stories that I've told. Certainly all of the doctors and the hospital the providers, we reach out to them so they know what it is that we do so they can refer people to us. A lot of people come to us because a family member had been on our hospice services and they had experienced that. So they said, my mom was on hospice services. And so now I know when my aunt is ill, I know where to go. And one of the things that we do often and best is is to answer questions. You know, a phone call is not a commitment. if people want to know, they wonder, you know, is it time? If you're wondering if it's time for hospice, it might be. But just to call up and get the information and be informed, then you can have that in your pocket, you know, if and when the time comes that you might need our services.
Now, for the listener, I met with Susan last week and had coffee. And if you're like me, hospice might be a bit of a mystery in general, mm-hmm. and it's a really big thing. And so today I was hoping we could demystify it a little bit.
Sure. One of my favorite things.
So when I think about hospice, or when I at least initially think about hospice, I am just picturing kind of a clinical room, white walls, of course, with white sheets and maybe a really sad little window, but just somewhere for someone to go and spend their last couple of days. But that's not really the picture that you painted for me when we sat and talked.
No, so far from that. You know, hospice is not a place. And that's the first thing, is that when people hear hospice, they think that it is that kind of a facility, or, you know, our hospice homes where people go for the last few days of their life to die. But hospice is a specialized field of medicine. It's a philosophy of care. It's not a place. Of our patients, about 85% of them are outpatients. In other words, they're in their own homes, you know, whether that's their home here in town or out on the ranch or in Midwest, or assisted living, skilled nursing, wherever it is their home, then we go to them. The hospice homes are for a higher level of care or symptom management. And the homes, we call them homes for a very specific purpose. And so I will give you this invitation now. You come by and I'll give you a tour, and you can see that it's very far from what you described. We purposefully build those homes so that families can gather there. There are big common rooms. There's a kitchen where right now the families can't cook in the kitchen because that's kind of the aftermath of COVID. But there are gathering spaces. There are fireplaces. There are little areas for the kiddos to play in. We encourage families to come and be a part of that. The rooms themselves are suites. They're made to look homey and warm and bright, and have their own bathrooms. They're really quite lovely in there. So we want to make sure that the patient and their family, because we take care of the families as well, you know, are as comfortable as they can be, because this is their journey. You know, our mission is to companion the end-of-life journey with skill and compassion. That means we walk alongside them. We don't tell them how to do things or how they want the end of their lives to look. What we want is for them to be comfortable and to find as much quality of life as they can in the time that is given to them.
Now, do you work with all ages?
Yes.
And not just like the family members, but are there even like young people that are at the end of their life?
Yes.
Okay, that's got to be really hard sometimes.
It is. And, you know, it's funny because almost all of us will give you some version of the same answer, Colby, when they say, oh, that work you do is really hard. Well, it can be, but it's also so rewarding, you know, because we're all going to get there. You know, there's none of us getting out of this life alive. We're all going to get there. So if I can be a small part of helping that family, of helping that patient get through this process and beyond, because after someone dies, you know, we still take care of the family through grief counseling. You know, we check in on them. They can always check in with us. If I can be a small part of that, that makes my heart sing. You do have to have a special heart and mindset to do this work, because it's not for everybody, because it can be difficult. It's about death. But if you have the right way to look at it, then what you see are those, we talk about good deaths and bad deaths. So, you know, a good death is, I'm thinking of a lady that had been in our care for quite some time. And when she started to decline and her family all came together, and she loved the outdoors and the weather was beautiful. So we wheeled her bed out to the patio, you know, and she was actively dying, and her family was all gathered around her, telling stories, laughing. All of us came out, you know, and had a chance to say goodbye. So we're all out in the sunshine, you know, filing by, saying our goodbyes. You know, that is a good death. You know, a bad death to me personally would to be in that clinical setting, hooked up to bells and whistles and tubes and, you know, with things going off and people trying to keep me alive if I'm not meant to be kept alive. That to me would be a bad death. I would rather go peacefully. So if I can be a part of that process, and you know, we all don't get to choose that. Sometimes it's just chosen for us. But, you know, that's what makes the work more fulfilling than it is difficult, if that makes any sense.
No, I can kind of picture, too, how you would be confronted with your own mortality all the time.
All the time.
And so maybe that helps to alleviate, if not totally banish, the fear of death.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. I mean, I can only speak for me personally, but it does alleviate it because it does demystify it. It's not this big, huge, scary thing that's out there I'm trying to hide from because I'm around it every day. That's not to say that it isn't still hard. And sometimes, you know, I'll see patients come in that are people that I know really, really well, or they're part of my family, my church family, or, you know, part of my close friends. And it does. It makes it very difficult. But I also know that they're being taken care of by the best. So that makes me feel better. That being said, I know that, you know, our directors, our executive director and our management, they're very cognizant of the fact that this can be very difficult work, very draining work, that it's hard on the soul. They keep a close eye on us as far as making sure that, well, I get my hands slapped if I get caught checking my emails on the weekends or off hours. You know, it's like, you are not supposed to be doing that. You're supposed to be taking care of yourself. We are mandated to take a full week off somewhere during the year, not just take a day here and a day there. It's like, no, you need to go away, go do something, get away from this so that you can kind of rebalance and reset, because it does take a lot out of you. And although all of our patients are so special to us and our transitions clients as well, you know, sometimes someone comes by that just has an extra special place in your heart, you know, or someone, you know, like the lady I described who had been with us for quite some time. And at their passing, that can be even more difficult, you know. So we will put together like a debrief or, you know, a moment where, okay, everybody who wants to talk about, you know, so-and-so's death and you know, talk about it, meet in the conference room and we'll all, you know, and our grief counselor, Todd, will, the grief care coordinator, will get us all together and kind of lead us through the process of.
For the listener just tuning in, I'm talking to Susan Burke about Wyoming Hospice and Transitions, and she's just touched on the mental health care available for grieving families. Do people want to do it, or is it kind of encouraged and then they find some peace maybe from it?
I think it's a very personal thing. You know, everybody processes grief differently. Children certainly process grief differently than adults do, and we're very cognizant of that. You know, it's not what I've experienced and what I have seen. It's not counseling in the like heavy duty psychological sense. What Todd does is help. He meets them where they are in this journey of grief. So, and tries to help them process it and understand that it's a very, very natural thing. And give them ideas of ways that they can move through it. I think, you know, there are, because of where we live, I think, you know, we're a pretty independent kind of, did I say independent earlier today? Yes. Mm-hmm. Independent state, and everybody pulls themselves up by their bootstraps and they're like, oh, okay, you know, I'm good. I can handle this. And plus sort of the predominant thought in society seems to be, you get over it, you know.
Right.
Okay, it's been 6 months. It's been a year. It's been 5 years. You should be over it by now. Well, you don't get over some things. You don't get over it. It's not a matter of getting over it. It's a matter of learning how to live without that person here on earth with you by your side? You know, how do you continue to move forward and grow without that person and the influence that they had on you previously? You don't get over it, you know. So I think that very long answer to your question, I think it just really depends on the person. We've had some people who have such strong support systems within their own family that work for them that they really don't need to take advantage of that. You know, they know that we're here if they need us. And they may find 5 years down the line, suddenly they do. You know, those things happen. But we have others who know from the get-go that they're going to need an extra hand to be able to process this.
I think it's important that that opportunity is there because, like you said, especially here in Wyoming, people are so independent, and I think sometimes it's just sort of rushed. I think that's cultural, but I do wish there were more spaces where people who wanted to kind of continue using that person's name and still remembering them out loud, that should still be.
And I think you just hit the nail on the head, too, with the remembering that person's name. And we do community remembrance ceremonies several times a year, and that is the crux of it, is to remember people's name, you know, so that you can say their name. Our memorial paver ceremony is the same thing, say their name. This grief care that we offer, by the way, is free to the whole community. It's not just for our patients and clients and families. You know, if somebody needs some advice and they need some grief care, or they're not sure if they do and they just want to talk to somebody, that's free to the whole community. It's just a service that we offer as part of the community. So I do wish more people would take advantage of it. It's kind of interesting, just, you know, I don't know if I want to go down this road, but sometimes there's a difference between genders on how they process grief and what I'll put my hand up and say, this is my personal experience, that's my disclaimer. But, you know, more often I will find that myself or the women in my life or family will grieve more openly than the men. And I don't know if that's a cultural difference. It's just something that I've experienced, whether I have a bias hearing it that way. But I know, you know, I'm thinking of one of my close male relatives. And again, when my mother died, Mom loved Christmas. And she died just a few days after Christmas. So for me, I mean, the first one was, you know, impossible for all of us. But after that, Christmas was a wonderful memory for me because I could celebrate her in how much she loved Christmas. But for him and for my father, they wanted nothing to do with Christmas because it reminded them of Mom and it brought that hurt back up for them. So it's just a matter of how people process it.
And so you wear many hats. I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about transitions.
Yes. Our transitions program is... that's a program for people who are not ready for hospice. They don't have a terminal diagnosis, but they might have a life-limiting disease, COPD, congestive heart failure, maybe cancer. They're still getting treatment for. They're still looking for curative treatment. People who are very elderly and frail. There's just a number of different conditions. And what it is a non-medical, free program where help people stay in their homes and stay independent for as long as possible. So we have volunteers that come into the home and check on their person, and they may do some grocery shopping for them. They may just sit and talk for a while, you know, and offer a little bit of respite so their caregiver can go off and do something. We've been known to do transportation, you know, to a doctor's appointment, or to go shopping, or to pick up medicines, or, you know, the last time that I sat with one of our transitions clients, we knitted granny squares and played with the dog, and that's what we did. It's like I could remember how to start them, but not finish them, and she couldn't remember how to start them. So I'd start the granny square, and then I'd hand it over to her, and then we would just sit around crocheting. And what that offers, too, is besides that sense of companionship and connectedness, another set of eyes, sort of like Meals on Wheels functions. And so, you know, the volunteer can come back and say to our transitions coordinators, you know, I went to see Sally, and she didn't look as good as she did last week. Maybe we should check up on her. Dasa and Christine, our transitions coordinators, are case managers for those people. So they will also, they have this vast array of resources that they can point people to. Do you need help with your caregiving? Do you need help with your electric bill? Do you need, you know, and show them where to go and try to get them what they need. And again, that's just a free program that it's funded by grants and donations, and it's free to the community.
Are you guys able to meet all of the people in Natrona County that need it?
So far, we could use more volunteers, though. Hint, hint, nudge, nudge. We generally say that if you have a passion for doing something, we have something that you can do. Right now, it's Natrona and Converse County that we serve, you know, and we certainly are busy. We certainly could use more volunteers, but, you know, our census is high for both transitions, has 80-some. Our hospice program has one of the highest censuses that I've ever seen. And sometimes when I say that, Colby, people, their face falls a little bit and they go, like more people are dying. And it, you know, no, it's not that more people are dying or more people need the help. It's that more people are seeking the help because they understand what hospice is. They understand that it's a benefit. They understand that it's a wonderful thing, and they're more willing to seek that help, or they know that we're here. So I take that as a really, it's a good thing that we're able to help more people. And I think it's important to note, too, that we never turn anybody away for inability to pay. Well, we just don't do it. We have different programs where you can apply for a sliding scale or relief. And by the end of the year, we will have offered between $250,000 and $300,000 in charity care to our patients. So, you know, that should never be an obstacle to somebody getting the care that they need and deserve.
Now, slight transition.
Okay.
Even though I just asked you about transitions, no pun intended. November 11th is Veterans Day.
Yes.
So the veterans have been on my mind a lot lately. I'm wondering what strategies and services you guys have that are specific to veterans, mental health maybe, or anything that goes along with that.
Yes, we are a member of We Honor Veterans, which is a national organization under the umbrella of the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization. That's a lot of words. What it is a special program that directs us to what we call veteran-centric care. So anytime that a veteran comes on our services, they are noted as such. We look at a number of different factors, including, you know, where did they serve, maybe what kind of combat. For example, if they were in Vietnam, were they exposed to Agent Orange? Could that inform some of their health care with what is going on with them now? Sometimes at the end of life, PTSD will manifest itself where it has not before. So if we see a patient that's having certain behaviors, we might be able to find out that that is PTSD and therefore maneuver and manage those behaviors differently. We train our staff on all of these different aspects. We have constant training going on. We can look and make sure they have their DD-214, which is something that they need for the burial in the cemetery. Are they getting all the benefits that they need? We can direct them to the right people to check that out. They sometimes have earned a medal that they've never gotten, and we can help with that. Just anything that we can do to help that veteran and their family. We also have this amazing group of veteran volunteers. And when we have a veteran and patient, we try to pair them veteran to veteran. A lot of times the veteran patient or client will talk to their volunteer more openly and say more things than even their family has heard. You know, I hear stories often, I'm thinking of one in particular, where this gentleman just opened up to our volunteer and was telling him all these stories about his experience in the military and what had happened to him and all this. And when our volunteer went to leave, the veteran's wife said, "I have never heard any of that before. I have never heard him talk like that. It's just a matter of opening up like that." This group of veteran volunteers also, we do a what we call an honor salute, or as the guys call it, a pinning, because it's got a more military thing. And it's a special ceremony that we do for the veteran and family and friends and anybody who wants to come along. And we honor them for their service. We have a certificate we give them. We read a thing that says, thank you for your service in doing this. We have a flag. We have a special We Honor Veterans pin, and a nice blanket that's been crocheted by our volunteers and a challenge coin from Senator John Barrasso. And at the end of the ceremony, all the veterans in the room stand and salute that veteran patient to thank he or she for their ceremony or for their service. Hardly ever a dry eye in the house at the end of that. It's so moving. And sometimes our patient will say, that's the first time anyone's ever thanked me for my service, depending on where they served. And then a lot of times we just hang out and hear stories. It's like, so tell me a story about, we've heard of plane crashes and ocean rescues and serving on battleships and all kinds of interesting things. We do have some Veterans Day activities scheduled. So if people want to watch our Facebook page, and we'll certainly let you know about them too. One of the things we're doing is we have an honor wall in one of our homes that has the names of all of our veteran patients. We're creating a virtual honor wall, so that will live on our website. And our hopeful launch for that will be, I believe, on the 8th, the Wednesday before.
How are your staff members using creativity and ingenuity to make hospice patients' dreams come true?
Oh, gosh. How long is the show? Half an hour? I see all kinds of really interesting and beautiful things. I'm thinking of one patient we have in particular, and you may have seen her on our Facebook page or other places. She is in one of our hospice homes, and she values her independence so much. She has a motorized scooter, and she wanted to go out and scoot around the neighborhood. Well, there were some concerns about that, obviously about how can we honor this and plus keep her safe. So the family met, the staff met, everybody, and they came up with some solutions. Okay, the chair's got to be charged up. She's got to have some ID on her that said, hey, if anything happens, call these people at hospice. And she has her little dog that jumps on, little Sis is the name of the dog, jumps onto her lap or the footrest and rides around with her. And that was one of those things where you could easily say, oh, no, we can't allow that. You can't leave But that wasn't what she wanted. And that's not what the family wanted. And so they found a way to make that happen. That same lady is a horsewoman. She used to raise and show horses. And her friends called her the horse whisperer. And one of the things that she wanted to do was go visit the horses. So we partnered with people and we found a way to make that happen and got her on a transport and took her out to our Reach for a Star Riding Academy that does our kids' grief camp every year. And Carol Santa Stephen brought out three horses. And we also picked up her husband from the nursing home and got them both out there. And these horses, we brought them out to her. And she breathed in that earthy smell of those horses and hugged them and fed them carrots and groomed them and nuzzled them. And it was just amazing, to be able to make that happen for her. We've had patients who wanted to go fishing, so a volunteer would get them in the wheelchair and go fishing. We've had a couple of different car shows because we get, car guys in there, and they're like, I couldn't go to the car show this year. They brought the car show to him,
Oh, wow.
And we've done that a couple of times. Larry Kloster is the president of our board and a longtime volunteer, and he's with the Corvette Club. So, we've seen Corvettes go cruising by and, giving patients rides with that. One of the rooms, one of our staff members turned into a bar for a little while because the patient was missing being able to go to the bar. So she kind of turned it into a bar and got a big picture of the bike up over the window. And
brought you.
This has been Report to Wyoming, presented in the public interest by Town Square Media.